Hi, this is Jason DeMont from LifeAfterCubes.com. The following is an interview with Josh Steinitz. He's the CEO of NileGuide. NileGuide provides a one-stop resource for the best travel recommendations on the web. You can check out their website at NileGuide.com. Enjoy the interview.
Just kind of like to start off with a general background question. If you don't mind just telling me a little bit about yourself, kind of leading up to NileGuide.
Sure. Well, let's see. I started my career in the management consulting world, which kind of gave me the basic business toolkit, so to speak. Had kind of a mini MBA there, and you know, got a chance to be exposed to large companies, medium-sized companies, smaller departments within large and medium-sized companies, et cetera. So I got kind of the basic toolkit, but you know, it kind of didn't do two things that I really thought was requisite for my career. Number one, it wasn't connected to my personal passions in any way, shape, or form. In that, you know, I didn't feel a lot of fulfillment by kind of helping these companies be, you know, ever larger. Mm-hmm. And it also just kind of made me feel disconnected from really being able to, you know, move the needle in a material way. And so both of those things were important to me as I thought about, you know, what I wanted to do next. So I actually joined I left the consulting world, the management consulting world, and joined a small startup called Green Travel, which was focused on the eco and adventure travel space, which is an area close to my heart.
Yeah.
Sounds like yours as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was basically a jack of all trades. This was 99. We did all kinds of fun little kind of guerrilla marketing campaigns. We sponsored a team in the Eco Challenge and folks I went to college with. And we said, for every person, we said, instead of just writing you a fat check because we're a small startup, for every person you get to sign up for an email to follow you and join Green Travel, we'll give you a buck. And so they signed up, you know, 10,000 people, and we, you know, started building our email list. Did a bunch of things like that. We had a searchable database of adventure trips where we were passing leads on to tour operators. But, you know, it really turned out that certainly at that time, folks were out there leading the rafting trip down the Grand Canyon or biking through Tuscany. They weren't tracking leads through an online inventory system. It was really hard to kind of connect the dots between a lead and a transaction and get paid for it. But the good news is the people who take those kinds of trips are very attractive to advertisers. At the time, without really knowing what I was doing, I started kind of selling sponsorships and advertising and doing deals with corporate sponsors who essentially wanted to reach our audience, who were looking at these trips and reading that content. And so ultimately, I, you know, kind of succeeded in the space, in the new space that we kind of attacked, which was the media world. And we became the largest online travel publisher. We bought the domain away.com and relaunched at away.com. We bought Outside Magazine's web assets, essentially, and ran Outside Online. We bought a site called GORP, Great Outdoor Recreation Pages. And, you know, at the time, we were larger than Lonely Planet and Fromers and all those guys. So we ultimately sold the business to Orbitz in late 2004, beginning of 2005, right as Orbitz themselves was getting bought by an even larger conglomerate called Sendit.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist any longer. It was kind of a mishmash of a bunch of different brands and assets. And I stuck around there for kind of a year and a half, and it kind of became clear to me once again that I was not a big company kind of guy. And as much as I enjoyed, you know, kind of running a small team there, I didn't feel like I was as closely connected to being able to make things happen and was kind of stymied by a lot of the politics involved. So left Orbitz and started NileGuide in 2006. Raised some friends and family money, spun up kind of alpha demo product, used that to raise a small venture round, spun up a broader kind of beta product, using that to raise a larger kind of first real size venture round, and then have been, you know, investing in building the product, scaling out our content, and the right team members on board, and starting to really grow a business ever since.
Wow. Let me go back to Green Travel. What was, how, How did you find that opportunity, and how many people were there kind of when you joined?
I found that opportunity strangely through a college email discussion list. It's just like kind of the Princeton alumni network list. A guy who'd been a McKinsey consultant had put out a posting asking some unrelated question about, I can't remember. I think it was how to structure, stock option compensation for new employees at a startup or something. And I just saw his post, and we started a dialogue. And company's based in D.C., and I had just moved out to San Francisco, so timing wasn't great, even though I'm from Maryland area originally. But we basically struck up a relationship, and he hired me. I was, I guess, probably the third business employee. I joined the same week as the kind of the CFO, and there was maybe one or two developers there, but I was basically one of the first employees.
Nice. That's a very cool story of getting into such a great and successful startup, just kind of off the bat. That's really cool.
Well, we went through our challenges too, right? I mean, I was into that space because, I'd actually written my thesis on ecotourism. As I mentioned, I'm a passionate adventure traveler and traveled all over the globe, so I knew I was interested in the space. But we also made our share of mistakes. We bought, a bookstore and a place called adventurestraveler.com in Vermont. We bought a site that had a call center in Portland, Maine for booking adventure trips that we ultimately had to disband. We did some other things, and we probably grew from 3 to 120 employees and then back down to 40 or 50. But ultimately, we survived the kind of dot-com 1.0 bust and built a, it's not a YouTube or a Groupon, but it was successful enough to find a good home and be part of something larger.
I meant to ask, what did you study in school?
My degree is from the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton, so kind of public policy and international relations, and I had a focus on environmental studies.
Okay, great. I was curious to see if it's a web development back, a computer science type background or something different.
No, that definitely would have made it easier if I had the capacity to code. And I'd highly recommend anyone who's ultimately considering a career in entrepreneurship, or kind of sees that fire within the belly to have at least that toolkit. I certainly didn't, and it just means you're one step further away from being able to kind of kick off controlling your own destiny.
That makes sense. You gotta still find that developer to help you out. So let me move to Nile Guide then. So what was the kind of first inspiration for the idea?
One of the things that everyone hears or says when they hear that you're starting or planning to enter a space like travel that's so massive. I mean, it's a $200 billion online market. It's so competitive. Their first reaction is, "Wow, that's so much competition. How can you be different?" And for me, therein kind of lay the opportunity, which is that the problem in travel, certainly online travel content information, is not that there's a dearth of it. There's just In fact, there's an overwhelming amount of it. And so what I saw as the kind of challenge was helping people to cut through that clutter, to find what's relevant and interesting to them versus to create yet another layer of clutter. And in particular, that opportunity was converging on several trends I saw. One was the kind of new tools of interactivity that the web was starting to make available. Kayak had just come online, and you saw all kinds of fancy, Ajax, filtering and sorting and things that kind of the old days of just static HTML pages were going away. I saw this kind of, as I said, this massive amount of content, which was a huge opportunity to leverage content and process content that was already out there without recreating a wheel and starting another TripAdvisor, another Lonely Planet, another Yelp. But then adding a layer of relevancy again with this technology and with humans to make great recommendations. and make those recommendations a critical part of the trip planning experience, rather than trip planning just being about, you know, tools, adding things to your basket, much more about the content. And that was kind of a convergence of the archive of content that had been created over the last 10 years, the new technology that had become available, and then this opportunity I saw to kind of take the best of those trends and use it as essentially a delivery mechanism for great recommendations.
Were you there at the beginning? Was this your idea? How did that process work? And then also, my next question is going to be kind of on the bringing on the first developer and getting that first beta product out that you mentioned as well. I'm curious on that process.
Yeah, I mean, I started the company, but you know, there was different ways I could have gone about it. I took a look at purchasing another company and kind of using an existing product and platform and repurposing that and growing that into something ultimately I wanted. But in the end, that turned out to just be a leap too far, and I decided to just build it myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically kind of vetted several choices with whom I could start off a development project. I kind of looked at a distributed Razorfish type of model where, you know, you kind of contract for some development. I looked at kind of just one or two folks locally.
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked, and I ultimately settled on a team of offshore developers managed with an intermediary in Seattle, kind of was able to provide some product management in terms of requirements and specifications from their experience, alongside kind of the business requirements and ultimate, you know, product vision that I was setting.
Wow.
So that's how we kicked it off. And, you know, I was in parallel raising money. And, you know, I was spending it as fast as I raised it and sometimes spending it faster than I raised it. But, you know, that it was coming in one door and going out the other.
Yeah. That's pretty incredible. So you basically started on your own and found this person in Seattle, your intermediary, and with him you kind of worked out the product vision, and then he had developers in India working on it. Did I explain that correctly?
Well, two clarifications. One is I had a couple other guys that I was working with start, not initially.
Okay.
I was doing this on my own. In fact, I was doing this with a friend of mine early, like while it was just a couple PowerPoints and an idea. He ended up moving overseas, and then I was working on it solo for a while, ended up linking up with a couple other guys, one of whom ultimately became my business partner. The other one also helped contribute to getting the thing off the ground, although didn't stick around for very long and didn't participate in, you know, kind of fundraising or you know, kind of product launch or things like that. But
sure.
My other co-founder did stick around for, you know, 3 years. And so he and I worked, you know, closely together for quite a long time. But in terms of the developers, they're actually in the Ukraine.
Oh, okay. Sorry. And was the co-founder that worked with you for 3 years, business or technical?
Business.
Wow. So were the other two people that you mentioned, were either of them technical?
Not really. Both. Two other guys at various points came on board for short periods. As I mentioned, one at the early days and one kind of shortly after the early days for kind of short periods of time. And ultimately, I think we and they were hoping they would fill that kind of technical role, that technical product role. But ultimately, it had been so far since they had done any, you know, long since they had done any coding, or, you know, they were just at a stage in their career, but that didn't make sense. But ultimately, we needed some different expertise there.
Gotcha. Oh, that's very interesting. Let's see here. So maybe kind of I'm interested in, again, in the kind of the early stages of Nile Guide. So you were working with your developers offshore, you were raising money. Could you tell me a little bit more about the early days and kind of getting ramped up to maybe the first or second round of venture capital? How did the process work? How did the company grow? Any pivots, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no rule book or roadmap for this stuff, so a lot of it is just learning by doing, and you know, you make mistakes, and the important thing is not to make the same mistake twice. You know, there are certain kind of basic truisms. You know, the offshore development can be cost effective, but it can also mean that, you know, you're less agile because you have to kind of over specify things, and there's a time lag, and then you know, it might be clunky code that you might have to fix later. But, you know, looking backwards, those are all things that you could say, I wish I had done differently. But at the time, you know, you work with the resources. It's all about timing and circumstance, right? If you start out with $5 million and the question is, what's the best way to spend this $5 million to build this product? You know, what you're going to do is very different than if you have $250,000 and the explicit entire goal of that $250,000 is building a alpha demo product that you can use to raise a more meaningful case. That was the goal. Our goal was not to build the ultimate be all end all product for $250,000. It was to build something that could showcase the concept and the vision that we were going after. And that's what it did. It was just for San Francisco. It was a clunky, crappy UI, you know, built by Ukrainians. But it showcased the potential of being able to filter and sort to essentially dynamically receive recommendations, and even to create your own custom downloadable guide to take with you on your, which is this, you know, this custom PDF that we enable you to take or send to your phone. At the time, we didn't have the iPhone app, but we had that functionality. So it was working on a reasonably discrete amount of content, which limited the complexity of the system, but and it didn't look pretty. But at least showcased how compelling that could be. And that was the goal of that first friends and family round. And then at the same time, the goal of the kind of first venture round was to build up a small team to show that, you know, we could have an impressive executive team as well as, you know, a few folks who could actually, you know, get shit done and weren't just overhead, although everyone's getting stuff done when you're at a startup, no matter what your title. And we didn't want to be reliant entirely on offshore development because that's just not long-term, very defensible, and it's not a great place to be. So we hired some people, and we built up enough of a team locally with the goal of ultimately replacing the offshore team, although that took another year or two to finally wean ourselves off. And we raised a larger round, and we had, you know, a number of term sheets, and we had to negotiate, but we ultimately found, you know, a couple strong new investors.
How big is the company now? I don't know if you can, like, employees. I don't know what you feel comfortable sharing and what you don't, but I'm curious.
NowGuide, we have about 20 employees today, although our footprint is considerably larger because over 100 local experts around the world writing for us. We have a community of 100,000 Localite, which Localite is a company we bought in the spring. So, you know, we have a kind of a considerable footprint or opportunity to create, you know, content and explicitly kind of for travelers by locals. What's really special and unique about NileGuide's ability to deliver recommendations is that's really based, you know, on local expertise. Right? Great recommendations for travel based on real local expertise. That's something that you'll never find on a, you know, a traditional travel guide site, nor will you find it on a traditional, you know, just a UGC user review site. We've got, you know, the boots on the ground, and we've got kind of the Yahoo Answers for travel, and we've got the about.com for travel, and we've got the software that processes and semantically analyzes all partner content that we have access to. So we're kind of trying to be as objective as possible and saying, hey, you know, we've got all three legs of the kind of content stool. We've got great content from Fromers and TripAdvisor and OpenTable and all those folks. We've got our own network of local editors, and then we've got a community of content creators. And so it's like, you know, pick your poison. So that's kind of where we are from a team perspective. We've got about 1 million visitors a month. And you know, our goal is to continue to grow that as well as, of course, revenue over the course of next year.
Very cool. I do want to be respectful of your time, so maybe I'll just a couple quick wrap-up questions. What advice would you give a new entrepreneur interested in the travel space?
Good question. I guess a couple points I'd throw out. Definitely don't subscribe to the "if you build it, they will come" mentality. You know, there's no such tools don't create customers in and of themselves, and if you don't really think about customer acquisition and how users will find your site naturally, or how, you know, via social media or via natural search, or word of mouth, but you know, that's tough. You know, the web's a crowded place, right? So just think about how customers, how your product will have customer acquisition baked into the product itself. I think that's really critical. It has, and I think I don't see enough of that. I see people kind of thinking, well, hey, I use this, hence, you know, this will become widely accepted and popular. Definitely don't fall into the kind of, you know, navel gazing. And it's easy to do because you're working hard on it, and your friends and family say it's great and really cool. But there's a million and one travel sites out there, and there's a few places where people are actually, you know, when we're talking people, I'm talking millions and millions of people are actually looking for travel. And that's, you know, Google, and to some lesser extent, you know, Facebook. And then, you know, the few large brands that have carved out enough of a customer base to generate, you know, direct repeat traffic, and that's because they're doing TV ad campaigns and all kinds of other things. So, yes, travel is big, which is great, but it's also really important to think about, find your product and then how to use it. The other alternative, of course, is that you could build a product that monetizes so well from day one that you can literally afford to buy all the traffic you'll ever need. I've only seen a few sites that do that. Usually they do it the other way around, but it's certainly possible if you build just a truly awesome mousetrap, and you know, and you have the scale to make it work right away, then you know, essentially create your own scale. So that's another option, but it's hard to do that. And I guess the last is just, you know, kind of don't wait. I mean, you see this a lot, but don't wait and for the perfect product. Get something out there and then iterate and test rigorously, fast, all the time. And you know, don't make let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I mean, it's never going to be perfect, but it's also important to actually get something out there and then just be super analytical about how you decide, you know, what to do next. You know, does A beat B, does C beat A, you know, just keep cranking on those cycles until you make it better and better and better.
Great. I guess last question then. What's coming next for NileGuide?
Well, NileGuide has kind of just gone through a evolution away from kind of explicitly being about trip planning, precisely because of some of the challenges I mentioned to you earlier, where you know tools don't create customers in of themselves. You know, trip planning sounds great, but 5% of the people want to plan trips. 95% of the people want to just find stuff and search for stuff. And I see lots and lots of trip builder, trip itinerary startups coming out again, and they'll fall into that same trap where it's just a complicated tool that no matter how cool it is, not enough people will ever use it. So we are in the process of moving away from explicitly focusing on trip planning, and again, really focusing on the content back to that value proposition I mentioned to you, which is, you know, great travel recommendations based on local expertise. And that means we're explicitly focusing on building up our Q&A capacity with our global community. It means we're explicitly focusing on ramping our original content from our network of local editors. And it means that we're starting to really think about how that content gets delivered in a user interface that engages users so they don't bounce and spend a lot of time on our site, and that enables them to kind of do things that actually support a business, like look at ads and check rates for hotels and things like that, because ultimately, once you get to a certain size and stage in travel, you have to start proving that last, element, which is critical to any business, which is, support a big revenue base.
Very interesting. It's
kind of order of operations, right? I mean, everyone believes that travel is a highly monetizable space, so you gotta kind of build an audience. Because no one wants to have the world's most profitable three customer company, unless those customers are like Google, Facebook, and IBM or something.
Yeah.
But we had to start first with building an audience. But now that we've got some critical mass, time to start kind of flipping the switch and having driving revenue capture a greater share of our energy.
Yeah. Great. The stat you threw out at the end of 5% of people want to plan trips, 95% just want to find stuff. That was that's an interesting thought. I never heard that before.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Planning trips means different things to different people. I mean, people spend a lot of time online researching and planning, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I'm thinking about is actually organizing. That means that's a power user thing. That's like people who actually want to drag and drop days in the calendar, and, share and collaborate on what they're going to do on their itinerary and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The vast, vast majority of time and activity, and what typically supports a business model is, looking for content, whether you're just looking for inspiration or looking, actually doing research. There are some companies that have tried to turn the trip planning into more of a lead gen model like Tripology. But I'd say they kind of mixed results at best.
That'll do it. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, I'd love to hear it. You can send me an email at jason@lifeaftercubes.com.